This episode is brought to you by our friends at FB Autosport. There's nothing worse than spending your race weekend under your car missing sessions because you were too swamped to get everything done in time. Whether it's car prep, new car builds, or arrive and drive, FB Autosport has you covered for Time Attack, GLTC, or WRL. They even have cars you can rent now while you put the finishing touches on your latest race car project. Reach out to Rob at FB Autosport now and tell him that Slip Angle sent you to get your project car finished and get back on track. Welcome, everybody, to Slip Angle Show. I'm Abram Schmucker, and today... Oh,
man, that Austin Cabot intro.
Man, I really tried. I don't think I can do an Austin, but I can try.
You did great. You did great.
Adam is on the phone. I had a rough week. My dog was very sick, and then we had to put her down suddenly, which sucks. But Adam carried the load and recorded the show for Tuesday. It's Wednesday, and on the phone we have James Candelaria of Candelaria Racing Products, one of which you're probably quite familiar with, which is the Sentinel system, which is really common in WRL world. Hi, James.
Hey, Abe and Adam, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Man, Abe just dropped a bomb. His dog died, and now he's going on a mini vacation. So we're recording a podcast. But you've had an up and down week, Abe. Sorry about that stuff.
Well, I told you the other day that my dogs were coming home today. So my in-laws are upstairs. I'm down here in the basement recording a show. My other dog, the older one, looks as if she's aged like 5 years in the time that she's been gone because she's on some kind of medication and her, her face hair is falling out. So it's rough in our family right now.
Dude, what is going on, Abe?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I'm sorry you had a rough week, but we've been talking with James off and on for a while. A lot of people know his products, and we can pepper plenty of tech nerdery in, but I think we should talk about racing a little bit. James races in SCCA touring and WRL stuff that I know of, but what's your background? How did you get into this sport, James?
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks for having me again. I've been racing for about, I guess, 5 or 6 years now. I did a HPDE a while back with Hooked on Driving in the Northeast. And, as pretty much all of us, I was hooked immediately. I knew exactly this is where I wanted to spend all my money immediately.
I know what that's like.
Yeah. It was one of those things. It's like, and I brought the absolutely wrong car to the HPDE. I brought an 800 horsepower C5. Former drag car with drag radials on it to an HPDE. It went about as well as you can expect.
Yeah, we've had that guy in Novice before.
Oh yeah, I was definitely that guy.
Yeah,
but I got hooked, and then we started really learning the ropes. I did a lot with a street car. Started with a just obviously my list of cars doesn't get much better. I went from that drag car to a C7 Z06. Cool. As my next weapon of choice,
which is known, the C7 especially, the Z06 is known for its track prowess with all of its cooling issues.
Well, it's actually not so bad when you don't know how to drive.
Oh yeah, I get that. Yeah,
you don't overheat it real quick. By the time I started overheating it in one lap, I was like, all right, now it's time to buy a race car.
So, as a just as an aside, sometimes when automotive reviewers talk about cars from the factory, one critique is often, XYZ car, really can't do 20 minute sessions without, these considerations. And I'm thinking to myself, now that we are so deeply embedded in this, if you are a fast driver on any tire, what car do you know that can run 20 minute sessions on like a really, really fast HPDE without slowing down a little bit just to get the tires back?
Not much. Yeah,
not many, right? I mean, although I did have good experience with my C8. So I have a C8 Stingray Z51. Mm-hmm. And that actually went pretty good at Sebring for about 30 minutes. I pulled off the funny part is I pulled off the track, went to get fuel, and then we realized the electronic brake assist module had overheated. Because it threw a whole bunch of codes at me and the brake pedal went to mush. So, you know, it didn't happen on track, which is awesome. But the fact that it it chose to die at the fuel station was much appreciated.
I get that. Yeah.
So even with electronic braking, it still feels like a mushy pedal. I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's weird. So the electronic, we didn't boil the brakes. What happened was, so there's an electronic brake boost module there. So the booster is controlled by electronics mostly, and there's a mechanical booster behind it. So it increases pressure artificially, kind of half brake by wire. And once if that overheats, then you've got to really get into the pedal before the mechanical booster's there. Yeah.
So it's like a electronic over manual brakes almost.
Exactly. And it's really weird. Like it compensates for brake fade on its own because it's boosting pedal pressure and all that stuff.
That might be a problem.
Yeah, I always thought that was a bad idea.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a cool idea.
As it's described, it sounds a little bit like that technology transition period where like the E46 M3 SMG wasn't really a DCT. It was more like an automated pseudo manual gearbox.
Yep. Oh, yeah, it was a robot shifting like a T56. Aston Martin did that for a while.
Yeah. Yep.
So did Lamborghini, that stupid gearbox that they kept in the Aventador forever.
And the Ferrari F1 gearbox as well, I believe, right? In the 360 Modenas.
Yeah, those things were garbage. But yeah, I mean, the DCT's way better. I had a DCT in my WRL car last year at a M4 GT4. And that was awesome. The gearbox and the thing was ridiculous.
Supposedly, like the S54 E46 M3, that automated manual gearbox is like, it's terrible everywhere, but it's like pretty good on track, supposedly.
Well, it doesn't need to be smooth, right? I mean,
yeah, it's just clunky in a parking lot, but like there ain't no parking lots at Barber Motorsports Park. So,
yeah. Funny you should talk about Barber. I love driving that place, but like I hate getting there.
I've never been there, but Abe's been there a bunch.
Yeah, so. I haven't driven a ton of laps there. I think I've done like 2 or 3 DE days there. It is fun. It is.
Yeah, really you've gone fun. Down just to do a bunch of podcasts too. So you've been there probably 8 days now. But I've still time just never works out. So.
Yeah, I enjoy that place. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I've raced it a bunch with WRL. I've never raced it in a truly fast car. I raced it a little bit in my M4 GT4. But in GTO, you know, your power to weight's 9 to 1. So, I mean, they're fast, but they're not real fast cars.
They're
insane.
They're pretty fast. So, at Barber, what's a GTO car run?
Oh, geez, I'd have to look it up right now. It's my transmission died at Barber on race day one. I can't remember exactly, but I had a great group of co-drivers. And my buddy Jonathan Vasquez, Brian Gittinelli, who you may know, was a co-driver of mine.
Motorsports Reg. Yeah.
Yep, Brian's a great dude.
So the winning formula guys who have a Sentinel device in their car, thanks, James, ran the Miata at Mid Ohio the last week or two ago in GTO, which was
Robert Manicheri's Miata modified out of GLTC spec there, right?
Right. Yep. And they had a cool engine from 4-piston and they had a lot of really trick aero from Varus Engineering. I think those cars were running like the GTOs at Mid Ohio were like 32s, I think.
Yeah, I think the fastest was like a high 31 in race, and then I think weren't they in the 33s with the Miata or something like that? 31s.
Yeah, like high 33, 34. I think there was no way that they were going to win on pace. They were only going to win either on strategy or on consistency. Yeah,
it was fun to watch. Fun to watch on online and on Race Hero.
Yeah, I watched some of that from the Sentinel feed, and it looks like they were having fun. There was a they were keeping up with one of the Camaros in GTO for a while. It was neat. It's a Mid Ohio is a great track. It's a great track when it's not raining or snowing.
We've been there for both of us.
How dare you make so many demands on that racetrack?
Yeah. First time we ever rented it, for Grid Life, was a bunch of years ago. And on the way there, like, all the fields are white. There's slush on the side of the roads. And we're like, man, our first Mid-Ohio event is going to suck. And then the weather ended up being pretty good. But
I think there was actual ice on the circuit in the morning.
There was. We started half an hour late because they were running trucks around to break it up. But other than that, the weather was great.
I experienced it briefly during practice, and I was like, oh, Mid-Ohio is great, and then it started to sprinkle. I didn't realize, like, you know, how tricky Mid-Ohio was. Everyone talks about it, but I come into turn one, everything's fine. I go through turn two, all of a sudden I loop the car. I don't spin a lot of cars anymore, so I get on the radio. I'm like, oh, there's oil down in turn two. You know, let the rest of the team know. And my car chief comes back on and says, "That's not oil. That's Mid-Ohio. Bring it in.
That's the
you're on the wrong tire."
Yeah, there's just something about that. I mean, the amount of sealant that has been put on that track, and in varying amounts throughout the track, and then the asphalt's so polished, like, it's just so slick.
For a repave.
Yeah, it's they don't like to put money in that place except for maybe a little bit of paint over the rotten wood. But until it's like literally flooding, it's like pretty unpredictable. But once it's flooding, then it's like, okay, well, it's the same every lap, you know.
Stay out of the standing water and do your.
Yeah, best. then it's just properly terrible all the time. But it's like unpredictable terrible when it's like mixed conditions, you know.
The GTO lap, fast lap of the day was a 131.1 by the Supra from Hitman Racing. It looks like
that's really fast.
Yeah, that's moving. That's moving for an enduro, man. That's WRL GTO is no joke. But,
yeah, 200 tread wear tires. I mean, it's gotten to be a it's gotten to become a sprint race. 2 8-hour sprint races.
Yeah.
Honestly, and it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed my time there, but I'm back to my roots now. I'm back to sprint racing.
Yeah, what do you race? You race a Corvette in what, T1?
Yeah, I've got a full max effort T1 Corvette. I mean, we put all the effort into it. Put aero on it this year. We just rebuilt the drivetrain. We just put Motorsport ABS in it. And let me tell you, Motorsport ABS is a complete game changer.
Yeah, will you do a Bosch system
for dummies like me? What organization is T1 with? What are the specific, like, what are some of the high level rules specific to T1?
So Touring One is supposed to be a modified streetcar class, right? So Mustangs, Corvettes, Porsches, BMW. And it's
with SCCA, by the way.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's an SCCA class. So they've got four touring classes. T1 is supposed to be the pinnacle of that. It's kind of, the rules have moved a lot lately. So, you know, now we get GT4s that are classed in T1. And they're pretty much supposed to be on par with cars like mine, which are max effort, you know, builds. But my car, if you take a look at it on paper, really isn't really all that special. It's a C6 Z06 with a 7 liters LS7, Penske double adjustables, big brakes from Brembo, front and back. We did a Motorsport ABS system, and we did a aero package within the rules, little 2-inch splitter, and then a pretty decent rear wing.
Yeah, that sounds so ordinary. I think we get jaded by the stuff that we're around all the time. That sounds like a badass car. It's just
That sounds real fast. Yeah.
Oh, it's no joke. It'll do a 213 flat at Sebring. So it's on big tires. Like you said, it's 315 up front, 345s out back.
All right. So you gotta do me a favor.
Is this a BF Goodrich car or what do you got?
Oh no, it's a Hoosier car all around. Okay. It only smokes the purple crack.
Okay.
So you gotta do me a favor. Grid Life Universe doesn't currently live in my brain, at least in Florida. What are some tracks that maybe we would have a frame of reference for how fast this T1 car is?
Like Road Atlanta, AMP.
Yeah, like Road Atlanta would be a good one.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have not raced Road Atlanta in this car. How about New Jersey Motorsports Park?
You've been to Road America, haven't you?
I have, yeah. So we ran a 22 before we put the big upgrades on it. Okay. Road America.
That's pretty quick.
I think it'll be under 20s this year.
Yeah, T1 is no joke. It's like, it's big ground pounders, but like but not full tube frame and stuff like that. So
Swenson, when he was, he had a an NA modified ZR1 in our track mod group, ran 215 at Road America.
He ran 219s, I think, but that was on 200 treadwear. So pretty comparable, actually, like kind of right in the same ballpark. He's probably quite a bit lighter than T1 spec, though. That car was stripped out.
Oh yeah, so. I'm 3350 race weight. So after the race, the way SCCA does the weights is after the race. Now as you finish, you go across the scales.
Yep.
So I'm 3350 min weight.
Yeah, is I would imagine you got some ballast in that thing. What are those things? What does that weigh roughly without ballast?
Without ballast, I think this car's super light. I mean, it's probably without me. So take me out, take 200 pounds out of it. It's probably 2,900 pounds with ballast in it. We have two big old steel plates on the bottom.
Swenson did a 215, Adam. How dare you question me on time attack?
I swore he did a 219. I don't remember why I'm thinking a 19, but that was so long ago.
Yeah.
Like that was like our first year at Road America, like 4 or 5 years ago. That feels like two lifetimes ago.
Dude, that is moving. I can't wait to go back to Road America.
The first thing, so this was at the time, it was a ZR1 shell, but it was a big motor. I think it was 468. I think he had the same setup as Ferris, something like that.
Yep.
Big cam, lots of power. I think it was 600 plus wheel.
It was like 720 wheel, I think.
yeah. I'm sub 500 wheel and I have to wear a 70 millimeter restrictor plate. So.
Oh, well, there you go. The fun thing. So he had like a nine lives wing and on paper, it didn't look like a crazy car. It just made good power and it was well driven.
It had sequential too.
Man, sequentials are delicious. I had,
I drove a sequential.
First sequential in an E46 M3 with a built S54. And, we went to Summit Point and on 200 treadwear tires, and we just started knocking off, 17s like it was like nothing was happening. It was just like the owner of the car called me on the radio and I was being nice to it. And he's like, you've really got to yank the handle. Once I figured that out, it was just the best thing ever.
Man, it's just the coolest feeling, isn't it? I've only driven like one car with it, and it's just it's the coolest thing.
I drove a Drenth, and it was just it was just great. I wish I can put one in for T1 in my class. Okay. It'll cost me 150 pounds and about $30,000. So I kind of
That doesn't sound worth it.
No, they're not cheap, but I mean it does change the experience of your race car though.
Oh yeah, it'll be way faster. I guarantee you it'll be at least a second a lap faster.
You're gonna pay for some of it with weight, obviously, but that's like there's pluses and minuses to being able to shift like that fast.
What did you say the dumb stuff race weight was?
What's that?
What did you say the race weight was?
Oh, I'm 3350.
That seems really heavy.
I remember thinking
tires and brakes pretty good.
Yeah.
I remember thinking my old ITA CRX was a pig at race weight of 2250. Yeah, big difference. There's a lot more car underneath you.
Yeah, I just sent a picture of it in the chat if you want to check it out. It's she's pretty gorgeous.
I tuned into VIR Super Tour the other day, and with the Driver's Eye Live guys were doing talking about, and the first thing they're talking about is you and your Corvette. So I did get to see a little bit of it on that stream.
So these cars from factory they're not that heavy. So how much weight do you have to add to make the car compliant for T1?
Actually, they are kind of that heavy from the factory for sure. They're probably 3,600 pounds from the factory.
So really?
Once we take, they've gotten to be big. The Z06, the C6 Z06 might have been a little lighter. It might have been like 34-ish.
That's the aluminum chassis, right?
Yeah, aluminum frames. But all the streetcar stuff really adds up.
For sure. Yep.
Once you strip them out.
Who does prep work for you? Like, do you do a lot of the work yourself? Do you have a shop that you deal with? Or?
No, if you see me holding a wrench, you should run away. no, I mean, I'm not very good at it. I mean, I'll do basic stuff, brakes and whatnot. But Phoenix Performance built this car top to bottom. Andrew Accolante, Kurt Resitano, Marshall Mast, And yes. Obviously, the godfather over there, Joe Aquilante. I owe most of my racing growth to those guys.
There's some of the most, there's probably so many runoffs titles at that shop. Like, they've, between just like those three guys, I can think it's like 25 titles, isn't it?
Easily. Andrew himself's a 13-time national champion.
Yeah, it's insane how many times he's won the runoffs.
And he's coach. So, I mean, he's the guy who really upped my game over the past couple
years. And he's a young guy, too. He's not an older guy.
No, he's not. He's not even 40. The guy's early 30s, I think. Yeah.
So it's wild. The last time we had Jeff Brown on the show, we talked a lot about the Level 5 program and Scott Tucker and whatever else. And we spent quite a bit of time actually just talking about how hard it is to win the runoffs once.
Oh, yeah.
I managed to podium at the runoffs in 2020. I got lucky and managed to stand on the podium at Road America. But, winning it is just, man, that is a tall order.
There's qualifying to get there, which in the past bunch of years has basically been go to three super tours, or so they've had various mixes of regionals and super tours. And before that, it was called the majors races. But usually it's like three super tours, I believe. But then you can tell the people that did seven super tours and they dialed, and it's all they do is make this car perfect and make themselves as good as they can be. And they're still getting like 15th on average. Like it's really hard to win. Like it's pretty top shelf in most classes. So
it is. So I got to deal with Andrew Aquilante, Mark Bowden in my class, and a bunch of other, former national champions in my class. So yeah, I mean, winning is a tall order, but we got the race car this year, and I think I can make Andrew sweat a little bit. So we'll find out.
Mark Bowden is a fall line, right?
Yeah, man. They come with two tractor trailer full of race cars, and they're all beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous prep work out of Chicago area.
Yeah, it's Tom Herb drives a few of those cars. So you've got Mark drives a few. His son drives a couple. And then they got a big customer program, too.
Yeah. Yeah, really a lot of national titles there too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the runoffs is I've been to a bunch of them. I've never competed, but it's a different level of amateur stuff. Like they, for one weekend a year, they are the most pro show. They do a really great live stream. It's super fun to watch if people haven't watched it, to go back and they separate all the classes out generally into single classes, but they are long races too, so you can really you can see a lot about you can learn a lot about the SCCA clashing structure and stuff just by listening to or watching the runoff stuff. It's always fun. I kind of miss my time in SCCA, so I do miss my time in SCCA now that we're stuck with grid life. But
You guys have a really cool demo that SCCA is kind of missing. So I think
drive very much anymore.
Yeah. Well, if you have four jobs, Adam, I mean, come on.
I'm aware. Yeah, you've said you've listened into the show a little bit. You probably hear me bitching about how many jobs I'm doing. Yeah,
you guys used to be my my towing partner. So every time I would tow far, I'd throw on slip angle, or I would
used
throw
to
on.
Be. What is that?
We started talking about RVs too much. We lost everybody.
Well, no, my problem was when I did the WRL thing, I was working with Round 3 Racing and they would prep my car. So I ended up being the arrive and drive guy. So I didn't have the 13-hour tow anymore. So I'm back to my roots again. So you guys are getting much more playtime on my tows back and forth to racetracks.
On the show you did yesterday with Jeremy, I watched the documentary on Sunday night. Ashley actually watched it too. And I was looking at the Lemons paddock and I was like, man, these are our people. Look at those shitty RVs.
Yeah, I know. They have the worst RVs in Lemons. It's the best.
It's a badge of pride for them to have the worst everything.
Yeah, it's actually really fun. It's a fun paddock. I kind of missed that time too. We did a bunch of years in Lemons pre-grid life. But
did you do, when did you do Lemons, sorry. Adam? Like kind What's of that? Really early when it started?
Not that early. We were 2010, 2009 to 2012, maybe 2013.
What about you, James? Any Lemons for you?
No, never did Lemons. I mean, I did Champ, WRL, and SCCA and some NASA thing or two, but never did the Lemons thing.
Do you know our buddy Lester, who works with Round 3 Racing a bunch?
Oh, of course. Lester is one of my favorite people. Love that guy.
Isn't he the best? He's like the best.
He's always got a smile. He's always got a smile. He's never complaining. I mean, he's a great guy. He's worked on my car a bunch. I can't say enough good things about
him. Yeah, randomly, he just got into working with them. He drove with us for years and years and years. He pops into probably 3 or 4 Grid Life for Honda Meet weekends a year. But he's an exceptionally nice human being. I miss Lester. And I'm happy
also,
every time
he gets randomly, seen. Adam, he showed up on marketing material, or his car at least, on marketing material for Haggerty. And we were like, I know. That's Lester's car. What's going on?
Yeah, at PRI, like I'm walking through a hallway at PRI, and it's like it's Lester with his junky Integra is the best.
I love that guy. And there's a lot of really good guys in the Round 3 shop. You got Lester, you got Kevin. I'm not sure if you know Kevin Tong. He's another. He's actually starting to drive now as well. I think they're driving Civic, right? I think he's building a Civic. Yeah, not sure for what series.
And that's the Round 3 Racing is Brad McCall and his dad, right?
Yep, Brad's a good buddy of mine. He actually lives 6 doors down from me, literally in the same neighborhood.
Really?
Yeah, we moved to Florida because we got cold in New Jersey. And I called Brad and I said, hey, Brad, tell me about Boca Raton. And he starts showing me for sale ads in his neighborhood. And eventually, you know, a couple months later, I end up moving down here.
Well, tell him I said hi. I miss him from my super touring days at SCCA. He was I was on the STAC, the advisory committee, and he got my phone number somehow, and we used to randomly talk and text, and he was always pitching something. He was driving a BRZ at the time, I think. But yeah, super nice guy.
I think it was I think it was an FRS. Yeah, I think he
BRZ FRS, whatever.
Yeah,
I think he had a Jackson supercharged FRS at the time for a little while.
So
yeah, he sold that, and then I guess then he just started buying endurance cars and idiots like me.
Tons of Boxsters and whatever you guys run at Round 3 Racing. So.
Well, I met, funny story, I met Brad at the runoffs in Sonoma. We drove door to door in, I think it was 18 or 19. No, it was 18. For like 40 minutes, we got the all the television coverage, because literally going through the final hairpin at Sonoma door to door, like every lap, we couldn't put a sheet of paper between us.
Yeah.
That's how I met Brad. Funny. Small world.
It's a good way to meet somebody. Yeah, afterwards, if you didn't hit each other afterwards, you're usually pretty much best friends.
Yeah, I mean, and then 6 months later, we're doing the VIR Champ Car 24 hour and sharing a lake house. So yeah, it was fast friends.
So if you got into racing that early and you've only done DEs and stuff like 5-6 years ago, like did you jump right into wheel to wheel?
Yeah, I mean, we went from DE to wheel real quick. I mean, I bought a Phoenix prepped C5 Corvette, and like, okay. it was a race car, and I'm like, this is being wasted on DE. Let's go to school. And so I went to, where'd I go? I went to Lucas Oil at Sebring, and Tommy Byrne was my instructor, if you remember him from the old F1 days.
Mm-hmm. That's rad.
Yeah, super cool guy, man. The lap around Sebring in the van with a former F1 driver is hilarious.
I bet.
Going through turn 17 sideways in a 15 passenger church van was amazing.
Yeah, man. Those Chevy Expresses, they know how to get down, you know?
Yeah. So we did that. And then I just jumped in, did regionals as much as I could, and bought, you know, once I realized that, you know, I've kind of needed to step up because it became kind of repetitive. We went into the majors and, got shown how good I wasn't. And then I started to climb the ladder, and I think we're at the pointy end now.
Cool.
So, as kind of a racer and someone jumping in with both feet, Boca Raton is not what I would think of as the center of the universe for a lot of people. What prompts a move from New Jersey, which has a whole bunch of racetracks around it, to Florida, which has some racetracks around it, but also everything else is way far away?
Yeah, it was weather for me, man. We basically got to the point where there was nothing keeping us in a state that made our face hurt in the winter anymore. So we decided that we wanted to be warm all the time. And Sebring is pretty close, 2.5 hours. But you're right, everything else is really far away. We have Homestead. Actually, I'm racing next weekend with Farah at Homestead. It's about a little over an hour from me. Mm-hmm. You're right. Everything else cool is really far away. VIR is 12 hours. Barber is 11 plus hours.
11 hours to Barber. Good grief.
It's like 11 hours from Chicago too. But yeah, you said you don't like the drive to Barbara. I would imagine there's like no good route.
Well, no, it's incredibly boring. And I used to drive a big old motorhome, so it used to be kind of worse. I mean, you guys know what it's like towing with a motorhome.
I personally think it's the best, but
I mean, it has its advantages for sure. But you're going like 60, you know?
Nope. I'm foot to the wood going 78, dude. I don't know what you're talking about.
All right. Well, yeah, you have a little bit more risk tolerance than me.
Yeah, you just need to have a bigger RV, I think.
I have a Dynamax Force, so I had a Super C. I mean, it would do it. I wasn't going to do it.
Oh, man.
I just couldn't imagine trying to explain that to the insurance agent, how I just crashed, 35,000 pounds of stuff.
Yeah, downhill mine will clip 80, but we're right at the governor. But, the mechanically governed old school Cumminses really don't care about just banging the limiter. Just run that shit, man.
When I drove back from Gingerman last year, which was kind of one of the last big events for us with the Class A, I was not to the floor, and we were at like 78 on the way back from Gingerman to Louisville.
Yeah, big old.
It did
big
not feel like I was axles. Even stretching his legs. Actually,
oh, you had a tag axle on that thing.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Oh, that's the dream. Like my Super C had dual rear wheel but single axle.
Yeah,
I mean it was fine, but I don't know. I got tired of Florida. You're right. Yeah, Florida is too big. If you need to go all the way across it, it's 11 hours.
Yeah, that's so it's long.
Yeah, I've got to go up and then left.
It's so long. Like literally, we went to my Key West for spring break when I was like 20, right? I'm in a crappy old Honda Civic with my roommate. And we're like, yeah, dude, we're in Florida. And then you like look at, and this is like pre-cell phone GPS. You like looked at the borrowed TomTom and it's like 11 and a half hours to go. It's like, oh my gosh.
Dude, Key West is so far. It's 4 hours from me.
Yeah, it was ridiculous how big Florida is. It takes a long time to get across that.
It's 20 hours to COTA for me, and I love COTA. I really want to go back in a proper fast car.
That is far, man.
Yeah, it's 20. It's ridiculous. So, yeah, I mean, when I was doing the arrive and drive stuff, it was way less painful. But now I'm back to towing my own junk around. It's tough because I got to go to the Glen in the beginning of June, and then I got to go to Road America at the end of June. So
I got to go to Watkins Glen, and I got to go to Road America. Sounds horrible.
Yeah, I know. It's a tough life. Well, I'm trying to win the Super Tour this year, so if I do well at both events, I'll have enough points to clinch the Super Tour. So
okay, what's your tow to Watkins Glen like? That's got to be 25 hours. Yeah,
it's right around 20-ish. But my truck, unfortunately, I chose poorly. I have a 6.2 liter gasser in a 1500 with max tow, which gets literally 2 hours of fuel.
Oh man, you're stopping a lot.
Yeah.
Time to buy a new
bladder
truck.
Problems.
You're buying too many race cars. You got to buy a bigger truck.
So wait, I should have bought the 2500.
You talked a little bit about the BMW GT4 car. How was that your vehicle? Do you still have it, or like how does one find their way into a like a body in white type race car?
Interesting story goes back again to Brad McCall. At round three, I'd been a driver there for a while, and I was hanging out with him, I think, July 4th. And I was like, hey, instead of renting a car, would you guys run it with me and maintain it and just send me a bill? And, I'll find my drivers and all that, and I'll kind of run my own program. But you guys will service it and do all that stuff. And he was down with the idea, and then we looked together at trying to. He wanted one too, so we bought a package deal of two of them from Samantha Tan Racing.
Okay, so that would have been X SRO cars then, or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, thankfully these things don't hold their value hugely, so we got a good deal. But some of the problems that happen when you get a good deal is some of the equipment is, at the end of its, you're near the end of its service life. So, mine had some trouble. Brad's did a little bit better. It is what it is.
It sounds like you don't have that anymore.
Yeah. So we raced it for a little bit. We put a motor in it, we were running P2 at Road America when the motor popped and I was driving. actually, we were P1. We just came out of the pits, and we passed P2 in the pits. Come through turn 8 at Road America, and I hear a rod exit the vehicle.
So how does that work? You like, do you just call your local dealer and you're like, hey, here's the part number. I need one of these race engines, or is it more specialized than that?
No, that's what the really cool thing about BMW Motorsports is. They have motorsports dealers, and it's a BMW Motorsports engine. Yeah, it's going to cost more money, but like you have a place, you have a part number, and like you call, and it just shows up. Like, you know, yeah. I can't remember. We bought it from somebody in Carolina. I don't remember the name of the shop, the motorsport dealer, but like, yeah, it was there in like 4 days. And Mark Gamora, who is like a master tech on everything German, had it in the car for the next race, and you know, we were good to go.
Be honest. So how much is a BMW GT4 engine cost?
A lot. 18,000, I think, for the engine. And then we needed turbos, so it was like another $3,000 for turbos.
It's actually way better than I thought.
Yeah, I was prepared for worse. I mean, it's, you know, nobody likes that bill.
I mean, I know what people spend to build like a junkyard K24 to make another 50 wheel horsepower. Like, and it's a large percentage of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, like I said, it sucked, but you know, it is what it is, and you know, the car ran, the motor was great after that, until we had a little issue at Sebring. No, I wasn't driving, but the car is no longer with us.
Oh no, everybody all right?
Yeah, driver's okay. One of my drivers was going up through Bishop's Bend, and we ended up being 3 wide, us in the middle, and you know, the car to the right had ran out of racetrack, came in, and ended up with the making contact wheel to wheel, literally locked the two front wheels. Both cars went for a tumble. They rolled the cars 3-4 times, up on the Armco, cars caught fire. Not great times.
That's a big
wow.
That was a big one. I mean, and the car was great. I mean, we qualified really well. We were going to do really well, but you know, sometimes that's just racing. I mean, it's just, it's nothing you can do about it, you know, but just hoping the safety equipment does its job.
Yeah. Tire to tire stuff can do really weird things too.
I looked at the video, Adam, and I was like, I didn't understand the physics involved. I'm like, how these cars were not, I mean, they were not on the absolute limit of grip. I just didn't understand how it happened.
And they just exploded off the earth and flipped over, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it looks like somebody put a rocket on underneath of them and shot.
Isn't it
them
nuts? In the air. And people in GLDC complain to me like that we don't allow tire poke, and I'm like, well, this is why we don't allow tire poke, and we're probably not even hardly solving the problem.
Wheels should never wheels touching each other at that rotational speed. I mean, just does really bizarre.
Oh yeah, we've had a car end up inside the passenger side window of another car, and that was like a minor one. Like, it can do wild stuff. You can just literally flip a car over like that.
Yeah, it was not good. Yeah. But my driver was good and okay, and the red flag, and the guys over at Sebring are real pros. They had the track back up and running real quick. So. It's a shame because I love Sebring and I really wanted to drive the car there. It's, you know, it's probably my best racetrack now outside of New Jersey Motorsports Park.
So I've never driven Sebring, and I hear from everybody how bumpy it is. Can you put how bumpy it is in context of something else so that I can understand how bad it is?
Oh, you've driven NOLA, right?
Adam did. I didn't.
With the washboard front straight.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that, except in all the corners, like near the apexes and randomly throughout the racetrack.
Because it's literally like it's heaving slabs of concrete from World War II, basically, right?
Yeah, so it used to be a B-17 bomber training base.
Yep.
So they used to literally land B-17s on that back straight, that forever long back straight.
Yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, and they're never going to pave it. They're not going to rip it up because the concrete's 3 foot deep.
Yeah, literally.
I mean, not even exaggerating. So it's you know, it's going to be what it's going to be. It's the oldest racetrack in America, the oldest, the longest running endurance race in America. You know, it's one of those places that's just this is Sebring, and you either love it or hate it.
So is it getting? Does it get worse?
I don't think so. I don't think, you know, it's going, it gets materially worse. I don't, from all the few years I've been driving it, I don't think I've noticed a surface difference change. Like I know where all the bumps are. They're still in the right place. And unfortunately the fast line through, through the really high speed stuff involves going through the bumps. So your car, car setup has got to be soft, way softer than people, than most people think. And that's why I laugh at, you know, cars that I see that are really fast elsewhere and they don't make a setup change for Sebring. That's, you know, it's because they didn't anticipate how bumpy Sebring was.
So that, your setup, does that mean also like
full springs? Oh, sorry. We're triple talking. Sorry. Go ahead, Abe.
So, I think I was going to ask the same question as Adam. Like, obviously you can adjust dampers. I assume also you're changing spring rates and everything else to just try and soften the car up as much as possible.
Yeah. How crazy is that change?
Yeah. So for us, it's really damper changes. And the car is not super stiff. The guys at Phoenix, when they've set up Corvettes, they don't go ultra stiff on the car, even if it's, you know, glass smooth racetrack. And so I've learned to drive the car, a softer car. And so we soften up the dampers and we do a bar change at Sebring if necessary. It's not a huge swing for us, but the cars that are really tightly sprung, like the Porsche GT4s or the Cup cars, or some of the E92s that come out there, you can see they're just bouncing and they don't have the contact patch whereas my car, it's got a little bit of roll and the tire is still mostly on the pavement. And we can really take advantage of that.
So as you kind of go through corners, then obviously the outside tires are loaded up. If you go and you've got undulations in that spot, do you find yourself like losing in traction and recovering that traction during a given corner?
There's only a couple of corners that really, that I really spin the rear up, and that's going to be in, 17, if I'm really pushing like a, you know, full send quali lap at race pace. I don't attack the throttle that hard in those corners because I know what's there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You got to keep that traction somehow.
Yeah, we don't have a MoTeC in the car, so we don't have TC.
Are you allowed to do traction control in T1 or no?
Yeah, you can, but you know, MoTecs are really expensive.
Yeah, I know some SCCA classes don't allow it specifically, but
yeah, that's touring. So 2, 3, and 4 have much stricter rules on like what you can do. T1 has kind of turned into GT2 light. So you get a lot of the options and you can spend yourself into oblivion, unfortunately.
Yeah. You chose the wrong class, man.
Yeah, I know. I should just be driving a Civic, but I'm just not that good of a driver. I need more horsepower.
You also have to drive whatever tickles your fancy at the moment. And sometimes people like to go fast and make loud noises. So.
Yeah. I mean, I like turning money into noise. It's great.
So on that note, I would propose we take a very quick break and hear a word from our partners. And we will be back in just a minute and talk specifically about what Candelaria Racing Products does. Welcome back to the Slip Angle Podcast. We've got
Adam. Oh, man. It's been so long.
I know. It's a really long time. We've got James Candelaria, who talked quite a bit about race cars, which I love. And the other topic that I want to do or that I want to talk about is nerding out about technology and the gadgets that go into race cars.
Cool. That's it's right in my game.
And you built one and you sell it. So you're definitely the person to talk to.
So on like the technical side, what is your race cars is not your first career necessarily, and selling motorsport products isn't necessarily your first career. So how do you get your specific technical knowledge and training? What was your first career and how did it transition into, I need to make race car stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I started off as my really cut my teeth in IT consulting, Fortune 500 IT consulting. And then I kind of saw this niche that wasn't filled. This is 2007, where like I'm not sure how deep down the rabbit hole in IT you go, but storage was like super slow, right? All we had were hard drives in 2007. Like flash storage didn't really exist as a thing. I came across NAND flash memory and I looked at it and I was like, ooh, this has a lot of potential. So started looking at vendors and, you know, people were starting to make SSD drives, but like they were really, really, really expensive and also bad at writing stuff. They could read really fast, but they couldn't write stuff real fast. And especially if you're doing like random operations, if you did like big, like file transfer stuff, it worked good. But you know, I was like, well, I'm a software guy. I was a programmer. You know, I used to sling C code all the time. And I was like, well, I might be able to fix this. So we, you know, developed a the first, actually, believe it or not, the first all-flash enterprise storage array was built by my company that I founded in 2007, Whiptail Technologies. You know, we were a venture-backed startup. We took a lot of venture capital from a few different places you may have heard of, Ignition Partners, RRE Ventures, and Spring Mountain Capital. And then we built the business around, you know, being 1,000 times faster than the average hard disk storage array that existed in the data center.
So what was the, like, I'm sure the use case was varied, but like what your typical customer, what were they, what was their technical need trying to accomplish? What were they using your hardware to do?
So there's really kind of two or three major use cases. So virtualization was big on the scene back then, right? So you had VMware,
sure,
and you had Citrix doing their thing with Zen Desktop and Zen Server, and you had Microsoft with Hyper-V. And those things just ate storage arrays alive for performance and like just beating the storage array up with random operations. So that was one huge work use case. And the other was databases, right? So we got into the information, we got into the DOD, Central Intelligence, a bunch of other three-letter agencies, the NSA. So the intelligence community was big on really, really, really fast information retrieval and being able to correlate stuff really quickly.
Okay.
So those were the two major use cases.
And then what? So now you have this company and you're probably growing pretty rapidly. What were the first few years like?
It was insane. I mean, as a startup founder, I mean, I don't think I slept for 5 years, right? I mean, I had to, you know, it was all about growth. You know, we made very little money, if we ever made money. But we're selling big ticket items to, you know, the Fortune 500. So we got noticed, you know, about 4 or 5 years in. And all of a sudden I get summoned to have a meeting with, you know, Michael Dell's team in you know, down in Austin.
Weird.
And pretty cool. I mean, I do say the word summoned because like it wasn't really a request. you know, it was fun. And then, you know, everybody of the, you know, the wagon started to circle because in 2013, all the big players were starting to pick out which flash memory array provider they were going to buy. HP bought one, EMC bought one, got a great chance to meet Pat Gelsinger, who is the current CEO of Intel. He looked at our product for a purchase, ended up going a different way. And then we got a great offer from Cisco Systems in 2013. You know, yes, that's Cisco Systems, the guys who make all the routers and switches.
Yeah, right.
And they make this huge data, they have this huge data center business too, and they wanted us to be part of that.
That's wild.
Yeah. So that was kind of my, you know, how I got, you know, I've always been a nerd and, really put my head down on that startup. We had a great exit. I ended up with 3 issued patents from the U.S. Patent Office on, nice, solid state memory, algorithms. And, after that, I had some medical issues and so I kind of exited Cisco a little early. And then I kind of was looking for something else to do.
Well, I was hoping what you'd say was then I effed off for a little while and I decided to do something else.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that kind of happened, right? I mean, after I recovered from what was happening on the medical side, I kind of took some time off and I was like, you know what? I really, really, really like driving race cars. And, so I did that for a while, before I, founded, Candelaria Racing Products, which is funny. Because the thing you actually guys know me for is not our first product, but it's the only one that was ever really successful. So
what was your first one?
Our first product was something I called TCAS. So you guys ever watch IMSA, GTD, GTLM, that kind of stuff?
Sure.
Yep.
Okay, so if you ever watch Corvette Racing, they've got a, what they call their bogey system. They've got a rear view camera and with a radar sensor that kind of gives them an idea of how fast the approaching traffic is, and if there's overlap, you know, if you're clear to turn in, all that fun stuff. I took a look at that, and Bosch was selling it, and they wanted like $25,000 for it. And again, being a giant nerd, I was like, I could make this for a reasonable amount of money. So I did. I took a radar, 24 gigahertz radar sensor, hung it on the back of the Corvette, and really dialed in a warning system to let you know how fast people were approaching from behind and if they've made overlap with your quarter panel.
So, you and Adam and I did a video chat last week just to chit chat and whatever. And in your home office, you had, something that in my professional life and when I was in graduate school, we used to call physics creep. And physics creep was when you had like your soldering iron and electronics and your oscilloscope and all this stuff would typically live in a shop. But because you are at it all the time, it just like makes its way into your living space or your actual office. And we had our cameras on and I saw this all this stuff in your background. And I was like, all right, this guy knows what's up.
Yeah, it's a hazard of the profession. Like, you just don't want to be away from it. And like, you know, taking that trip down to most, my big lab is in a converted part of my garage, and it's like, it's, you know, 30 steps away, but you know, it's, you know, it just, it finds its way into every part of my life.
That's cool. Yeah. So, you started with that first product. Obviously that's like mega, mega niche. I bet there are, like, the total number of possible customers on the planet is probably, I don't know, less than 1,000, for people who want and need that product. So what did, like, then what?
Well, nobody bought it because you're right. The market was so small, like literally didn't sell one, spent a year and a half of my life developing it.
I'm sorry. That's I'm not laughing at you. That's a really funny.
Yeah, no, yeah, I laugh at it too, because it's like I saw the value in it, and you know, I do a lot of multi-class racing, and you know, just the situational awareness was great. But you know, everyone, the response was from everyone is, you should know what's behind you anyway.
Like, so, how did it send like the bogey itself? How did it send a signal to the driver? Was it audible? Was it a screen? What did you see, or how did you receive the signal from the sensor?
So you have, you've guys seen the Apex Pro, right?
Yep.
So basically the same type of display, except it was color coded. So if there was something behind you that was creeping up on you 5 miles an hour, it would be blue. If it was somebody creeping up on you at 10 mile an hour closure, it would be green. And if it was, somebody was, you know, if they were close and they were fast, it was red and it would be blinking at you. So it was color coded.
Was proximity also like, maybe based on the number of lights, not just the color. Okay. I think that's really cool, actually.
Yeah, I thought so too, but no one else did. So
yeah, I was going to say, is this something that you can put in any car, or do you have to have a certain vehicle for this?
Nope. Any car. So we actually made a license plate frame adapter for the radar module.
Right.
And, you basically, anything that had a license plate frame, you could just screw straight into that and then run the power and, CAN bus wires back to the controller.
Now I kind of want to start selling these things.
Yeah, these are super, super cool, because like at grassroots level, yeah, of course you should know the people behind you. But if you're a race team that doesn't have spotters all over the racetrack, having that like sort of extra eyes to help the driver, I like totally see the value in that.
Yeah, I won't lie. I mean, I race in a big bore group with, you know, T1's one of the second fastest class, or third fastest class. And the GT1 cars, they just appear out of nowhere. You know, like I look in my mirror exiting turn 16 at Sebring, or, you know, turn 12 at New Jersey Motorsports Park. And like, they're not there. But by the time I'm in the brake zone, they have suddenly appeared.
Yeah. And the first time I was at Road Atlanta, I was racing with NASA. 2015 or so, and I was in an H2 car, which was like it was kind of like a B-side STL car, And there was no other H2 cars, so they bumped me up into H1. They're like, you'll do fine in H1. Just go have fun, right? You can earn some Toyo bucks or whatever. And I was like, I don't care. It's fine. Sounds great. I'm just here to learn this track because we're hosting a festival in a year. And so I'm out there for qualifying or practice, and I had never been out there before. And they put really, really fast cars into their Thunder Group or whatever they call it.
Oh, yeah, they do.
And like, I mean, I'm in like 138 wheel horsepower car dropping down towards turn 10A. And I look in my mirror and I was like, oh my gosh, that car is coming so fast. And it was a twin turbo, like 935 Porsche. Yeah. And this thing went by me, like he must have been going 50 miles an hour faster. And like the whole car moved over to the left about 6 inches just in his aero wake. Like it was insane. And like, I saw him coming, but what if I didn't see him coming?
Yeah, I mean it could end badly. So So I thought this was a no brainer, but you know, nobody bought it, and so it's sitting mothballed. Actually, I still have all the parts. I don't have them even on my website anymore because I got just so disenfranchised. I was just like, I'm not going to make the effort if the market's not there. They've spoken, and it is what it is.
So. Yeah. I never heard of it, so maybe you just didn't market it well enough.
Yeah, I'm actually really bad at marketing, so I'm surprised that people even know who Sentinel is right now.
Yeah. Well, you got a cool product. So, how did the Sentinel come about?
Is Sentinel in the world? Second product?
Yeah, so Sentinel is definitely the second product, and as Adam asked, like it came about because I was often, like as I said before, a huge nerd, right? So I was often at the racetracks screwing around with GoPros and action cameras and 360 cameras and like just trying to get them to work for the entire race. And I tried messing around with actually live streaming in 2018 with a GoPro hotspotted to my phone from the runoffs. And that just flat out didn't work. And I spent so much time on it. I was like, I can do better than this. And so I did. I put my head down and I started developing what you now see as Sentinel.
And for people that aren't familiar with it, what does it all do? And what does it take to set it up, move it around car to car, et cetera?
Well, that's a good question. So Sentinel is a dedicated motorsports live streaming platform. So it really focuses on the live streaming element. It also does record directly to a USB stick, so you don't have to mess around with converters for your micro SD and all that fun stuff.
I actually wondered about that. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I was just like, I'm a racer and a dork, so all the stuff that really cheesed me off, I tried to make it easier for people to use. And that's really the killer thing is it's super easy to use. It's cloud based. You do it right from your phone. It's like a smarty cam in the fact that like if you set it up correctly, when you start moving more than 20 miles an hour, it's either broadcasting or recording or both.
Mm-hmm.
You can bring in up to three cameras and it'll do picture in picture. So a lot of times it comes with two out of the box. You can buy a third for not a lot of money. What you get is you get the front view, you get the driver view, and then you get the rear view. So some of my teams that have them set up with all three, I mean, it looks fantastic because you see what's going on behind you. You got the see what inputs the driver's making and the view out the windshield. And then you can also bring in the data, right? So if you have an AIM data system, we can hook straight into the CAN on the AIM side and overlay, throttle, brake, and then all the car health stuff too.
Mm. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's very cool. We know a bunch of people that have them and have used them. And it seems like a pretty flexible product. How much has it changed since you started building them? Like how rapidly do these things change?
Wow. Yeah. So good question, because they changed a lot from what we called our alpha release, which is serial numbers 1000 through 1025. And those were plastic housings, 3D printed plastic housings, but the brain and the guts and the software are still the same, right? So I can load the latest firmware on the oldest box.
Okay.
Denny, a buddy of mine, Denny Stripling, runs an SRF, so a spec racer Ford in SCCA land. And he has serial numbers 1001. So he has the second unit we ever sent in the field. We just updated it the other day. Still works great.
Cool.
So now I have a follow-up question about taking the concept into an alpha product. Like, your background is on the IT side. How do you, as someone maybe who is tangentially related to it, how do you go from a concept to the printed circuit board, to producing the printed circuit board, to integrating all those pieces of hardware?
Yeah. So when you're a small operation, you really have got to leverage, partners, and also, stuff as you can get off the shelf as possible. Yeah. So in our case, we use a off-the-shelf system on module from NVIDIA instead of building our own board.
Okay.
But we did build our own circuit boards for the CAN integration and some other stuff. So our driver tag system and that kind of stuff was custom built, and I did my own board layout. I happen to have a decent amount of experience with microcontroller design because I've done microcontroller work for some race series in the past. They needed something for timing and scoring and pit lane stuff, so I did that. So that translated into being able to build my own circuit boards. And then, as far as the software goes, I wrote it all myself. I have a deep experience in C and Python and all the various stuffs. The thing I hate, though, is the front end work. I did work with a good friend of mine who is a UI guy, and he put together the front end for me, and I did all the back end API.
Got it. Cool. So when did the product launch?
So 2021, we shipped our first units, February 2021.
Man, that's not long ago. I feel like everyone in WIL already has one.
I thought it was longer ago, actually.
Yeah, it feels like forever because I work 16 hours a day trying to make it better. But the 2021, and I think we count about almost 40 to 50% of the WIL field has one now.
Yeah. So how do you deal with the need for volume? Obviously, like, the WRL field isn't millions of units, but like, what is producing these things like in terms of like units per day? How many in that early period? How many did you have to start shipping as you started taking orders?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, scaling up was hard. I got a manufacturing partner that actually screws them together and solders in what needs to be done. He's out of New Jersey. He was able to ramp up. In the first year, we did like 100 units, almost 100 units. The next year, we did another like 60. And this year, I think we've already done 60 units because we launched our big V2 hardware refresh at PRI. And when we Adam and I just missed each other at PRI, a couple different times.
What about the physical electronics requirements to like be inside a race car? It is more complicated than just buying like run of the mill stuff. How do you? What are the specifications to which the equipment has to be built in a way that it'll survive that environment?
Yeah, we found really quickly that race cars are about the most hostile place you can try to put stuff. They're wet, they're hot, they vibrate like heck. They're not friendly.
At least they're generally not saltwater ridden, but that would probably be the only thing that could make it worse.
Yeah, I was gonna say the only thing worse is probably a boat.
Boats don't vibrate like race cars do, though.
Yeah, that's a good point. They're usually a little bit smoother, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. The environmentals we design around -40°C to positive 85°C, which is really hot. Our old system required active cooling, required a fan. So V1, all the plastic and then the sheet metal case for V1 required an active fan. When I designed the mechanicals for V2, I really wanted to get away from that just for, sealing, weather sealing reasons and just general, anything that spins will break at some point. So we went with a aluminum extruded housing. We have some thermal pads that actually, that dissipate the heat directly to the extruded housing. That keeps it cool. I mean, we've done, 48 hours. The CPU never gets above 50°C. Max thermal junction for the CPU is 95°C. So, we're well within tolerance, and we leave it out in the Florida sun, during the summer, and the temperature doesn't budge. So we got plenty of aluminum as a heatsink.
That's cool. I watched a little bit of the Winning Formula feed. I was supposed to be at that event helping them on the strategy side because, I have actually no interest anymore in like competitive driving, But endurance racing as a sport is interesting to me, not purely as a spectator, but rather like the strategy part of endurance racing, I think makes it really, really interesting. And in terms of the way an event is broadcast, I like having been on the GridLife live stream, sprint racing is really easy to understand because everyone's just driving as fast as they can. And endurance racing is a little bit more complicated than that because there is strategy involved on fuel strategy and when to pit on the basis of yellow flags. It's like, it is just inherently more complicated. Totally. What I wanted on the live feed from them is I wanted to hear my team, right? Like I wanted to hear what they were doing as a way for me to better understand the stream itself. So I think that's your product has a way to integrate the two directional audio.
So that's I'm actually staring at the harness that we built that I'm going to be testing this weekend at Farah at Homestead. We have a microphone input on the front of the unit, and we've adapted an IMSA cable to split off into a 3.5 millimeter jack, and we should be able to get two-way radio and make the helmet mic a hot mic source. So, you know, that's a good and a bad thing, right? I mean, depending on how hot-headed your drivers are.
Well, it depends on if you want it recorded or not, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've been caught saying stupid stuff while Sentinel was listening, so it happens. Yeah.
Well, it's a cool product. Do you have any other things that you want to build? Like, what's the next thing in Candelaria Racing Products?
Yeah, so we're building something really cool right now. So you, as you probably know, Sentinel is dependent on good cellular coverage, right? So if you can't get the signal out of the box and up to the YouTube or Facebooks of the world, there's nothing you can do. We can mitigate that risk by bonding network connections together from multiple carriers. And by doing that, you'll always be able to get an acceptable stream. May not be great. With your size of your events with GridLife, I mean, you guys show up and just melt cell towers.
Yeah, that happens.
It's a thing. I've seen it in person. Hopefully when you get, if you can get 500 kilobits out of one tower and 500 kilobits out of another, 1 megabit stream is definitely watchable on the typical way we consume video on cell phones and tablets and stuff. Yeah. So we're building a bonded solution. So I have an external 5G router, which we're building on our own, using a MediaTek chipset and some 5G stuff from a partner. And so we're going to launch that for Sentinel, as well as going to launch it as a standalone product for the Pit Box, as well as for, just your home router if you need one that has 5G backup. So that's kind of our next thing.
How does that work? Like when I have a cell phone plan, I pay a bill for access to, AT&T's towers or whatever. If you do this bonded setup, does the user have to consider being a subscriber to multiple places, or how do all those things mesh?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a thing, right? So you're going to need an AT&T account, a Verizon account, or a T-Mobile account, any one of the major three, and you're going to need to have both. But thankfully, the way Sentinel works, it works very well with your unlimited smartphone plan. So, those are fairly inexpensive these days. Sure. And we can also configure most likely a prepaid solution on the router side you just buy the bucket of gigabytes that you need. And it's very easy to calculate how many gigabytes you're going to need. I can, provide a little calculator on the website. And, this way people don't have to worry about a continuous bill. They can just buy a bucket of bits and go after it.
That's cool. That's a great idea. Yeah.
So I know everybody hates subscriptions, including me, which is why I only have one subscription plan for Sentinel, because we have some advanced features that cost me money because I have to run some stuff in the cloud. So I have to do it. But I'm never going to make it more than one thing. You pay for one subscription, you get all the things that Sentinel does on subscription.
What's the Sentinel Video Network subscription?
Yep. That's
what, what is that? Explain it.
So the guys at Driver's Eye Live love it because it gives them the low latency RTMP feed that they can feed into their production software. Mm-hmm. And so that gets them down to sub 3 seconds. And that really ensures that the Driver's Eye Live guys for WRL and also SCCA are going to pick you up in their feeds because they're always looking for onboards, but they don't want to scrape them out of YouTube, right? Scraping them out of YouTube, it could be 7 seconds, could be 30 seconds. If YouTube's having a bad day, you know, it could be, you know, however many seconds they're behind. So that's the big get in the Sentinel Video Network. We also have some other stuff, the network bonding stuff is going to be wrapped into that because I have to run a private VPN cloud to take the bits and to reassemble them into reasonable packets and send them onto the internet at large.
We did get nerdy here.
I told you, man.
Yeah, sorry. Huge dork.
The other cool thing
that we have now is this race monitor integration as well. So Race Heroes, great. Love the guys over there. Brian Gidinelli, like I said, mentioned before, good friend of mine. And their API is free, which is awesome. But not everybody uses them. So you end up having to have, you know, Race Monitor as well. But Race Monitor's API is not free.
Yep.
So that's a little annoying. And so I have to pass on some cost there.
Yeah, that was $10 a year.
Oh yeah, for you as a user, it's $10 a year. Not for me to scrape the API.
that I would imagine is definitely different. Yeah,
yeah. No, it's like $100 a month or more, depending on my volume. So I mean, there's just cost there.
Mm-hmm. So makes sense.
When you use the Race Monitor integration, what happens? Like, does it complement the video, or does it? Send information to the video itself? Like, what works there?
Oh yeah. So both Race Monitor and Race Hero will overlay live timing and scoring right on the screen. Right. So we have a couple different modes. The default mode that most people run is best lap, last lap, current position and flag status. So those are like the most important stuff. We also do have a leaderboard function, which we kind of really want to re-engineer soon to make it more visually attractive. But if you turn that on, you can see who's ahead of you and who's behind you and calculate the gaps. So the watcher can understand, well, hey, I've got Random Vandals is, five tenths back. And, I'm currently running in seconds. So, I need to tell this driver to maintain the gap or what have you. Mm-hmm.
So I think when we had Jeff Brown on the show, he said, or maybe it was a combination of people who said that, grassroots motorsports is generally like 20 years behind like IMSA or, you know, WEC or really, really high level stuff. We were talking about some of the hardware and the technology and all the information that goes to the series to make IMSA what it is and make it scrutinized in the way that it is for competition and things. What do you think the frontiers are in grassroots motorsports?
I think there's a lot of opportunity around compliance, right? So racing in WRL for a while, there was a lot of protests and there was a lot of people getting DQ'd for stuff. And, I think there's an opportunity, especially in these power to weight series, to really automate the compliance checks and figure out if someone's not playing fair. I actually developed a piece of hardware, which we called Tattletale. And it was it consisted of an IMU, so inertial monitoring unit. So basically accelerometers and stuff that basically proved how much horsepower you had by doing a lot of math.
Yep.
And so you didn't just show up at the dyno and hit a switch and make less horsepower, you know?
Yeah. So we actually monitor a lot of acceleration rate in GLTC for that same reason. It's a little bit more burdensome, but yeah, it's definitely a thing you have to.
I think it's a especially interesting discussion though, because I'd be interested in your perspective. It is, even if cars make exactly the same horsepower, it is not virtually guaranteed that they will accelerate the same way because they will have differing amounts of aerodynamic drag. So like, how do you square that circle?
So, I mean, you have to take a base, a base coefficient of drag, and then apply it. And if you exceed this, then you're on the let's monitor this guy list.
Right.
So what we did with Tattletale, was we actually made it so it uploaded on every single lap directly to a backend, and that backend would do the math for you. And it would basically alert race control when things got out of a certain parameter list, and put them on a watch list.
Adam, that sounds cool. We should buy that.
Yeah, I kind of want to buy that.
Yeah, man. Well, we could talk offline about that because we stopped development on it, but the hardware, all I've got all the PC board designs and all that stuff sitting in a file somewhere.
Interesting. Yeah, I like that.
And we use a little IoT sim, so it costs you, you know, $5 or so per car per year to have the cellular access because it's literally just sending, you know, data every, you know, little bits of data every lap. So
right now we have to pay a dude to run around and pull as much data as he can. And then he throws it all into an aggregator that Fire Labs has worked on with us. And that's how we do it. But it's very labor intensive for sure. And it's definitely not real time. So,
yeah, I mean, for a sprint series, real time, I guess, doesn't matter nearly as much. But for an endurance series, real time can be a huge saver.
Oh, yeah, especially if you suspect that, you know, a car has more, but they're sandbagging, but then they use more when they have it. Like, you'd want to see all the laps. Yeah.
And the other fun thing about endurance racing, just going back to the Sentinel thing, is we've had Sentinel and being real time has allowed us to overturn penalties or enforce penalties. Race Control loves it. I'm not sure if you ever talked to RJ. You know, he's used it in Race Control many times to do rule enforcement. So I think, you know, real time is real important in my opinion. I mean, that's just, but I'm colored because I've done a ton of endurance racing.
Especially for enduros. Yeah, especially for that.
Super, super
cool. Well, I have to run and pick up my daughter, so I need to stop having so much fun with you guys. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate it. I'm glad we were able to connect.
Yeah, I've greatly enjoyed it. If you guys want to keep nerding out, you can feel free to do so.
I also have to go because I have to pack my bag. We're leaving at probably 6 tomorrow morning, and it's currently 9 o'clock, and I haven't done anything in preparation, so I probably got to go.
Super fun. Super fun trip ahead of Abe, but super, I really enjoyed the conversation tonight. So,
yeah, great stuff. Thanks for having me as a guest, guys. Appreciate it.
James, stay on the line for just a second, but where can people find your products?
So Candelaria-Racing.com. And if that's too many letters for you, just go to SentinelVideo.net. And you'll find all of our stuff there. Right now, everything lists as pre-order for Sentinel V2. Don't worry, it's actually in production. It's just listed as pre-order right now because I do not have enough units on the shelf to click and ship. You may have to wait, you know, a week before we can ship your unit. But I'm getting more units in from production every day.
Awesome. Yeah, very cool product.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you, guys.
Good luck on Super Tour this year.
Yeah, next stop is Watkins Glen. So
us too, actually.
Yeah, we're going there. Actually,
I'm gonna send one of my guys up there if that's okay with you guys to spread the Sentinel word and see if we can get some more systems for you guys to play with.
Guest tickets are available. Let's see them. Let's see it, dude. we got that figured out.
Bye, guys.
All right, guys. Cheers.
Slip Angle was created by Austin Cabot and Adam Jabe, co-hosted by Derek Yarbrough and production by Abram Schmucker, who mixes all of our terrible audio. If you like the show, please rate us and review us on iTunes and come and find us in the pits at a grid live to say hello.